Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. This week, we're looking at Utah's 50-year water strategy, at the formal announcement by Salt Lake County Councilwoman Jenny Wilson that she's running to replace Senator Orrin Hatch. The nomination, finally, of Utah Governor John Huntsman Jr. as ambassador to Russia, the protracted battle over health care, and the deal struck for the retirement of Gary Ott. Joining me for this conversation today, Salt Lake Tribune government editor Dan Harry. Welcome back, Dan.
Good morning, Roger.
Environment reporter Emma Penrod is here in studio. Thanks for joining us, Emma.
No problem.
And on the phone, we've got Salt Lake Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr. Hello, Tommy. Good morning.
Hey, good morning.
You can join us during this Friday morning news wrap-up. Weigh in with your questions and comments at sltrib.com or the KCPW Facebook page, or call us at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. And it's hard to know where to start here, but Dan Harry, some news that broke yesterday relating to county government. Actually, a couple of stories on this, both of them having to do with Salt Lake County recorder Gary Ott, who has been apparently suffering from diminished mental capacity for some time. And let's start with the most recent of these stories. A deal has been struck for Ott's resignation. How did that happen, and what is the deal?
So the deal is, and this was struck with Ott's family, basically his siblings, and the county will agree to pay $35,000, which is equal to 12 weeks of salary for Gary Ott.
Okay.
And for their part, they will waive any claims that they might have against the county for, well, anything,
right.
Any kind of liability at all. And the deal calls for him to step down officially August 1.
Can you, Dan, just remind us what's been going on at the county recorder's office or what appears to have been going on during the past year and a half, 2 years? I'm not certain how long it's been and how this came to light.
Well, as it turns out, we apparently don't know much about what's going on, because at what it looks like from hundreds of documents that were released earlier this week by the county, is that the two top aides to Gary Ott, his chief deputy, Julie Dole, and his exempt secretary and girlfriend, Carmen Sinone, were basically running the office, it looks like, from these emails. And not only that, but were sort of trying to disguise the fact that they had taken over his email account. They were responding to emails for him, even to the mayor's office, to reporters, to other departments in the county. And at one point, one email said, "How do I make this email look like it's coming from Gary?"
Right.
So, you know, that's been the accusation that's been hanging out there, is that these two aides are benefiting from this personally because they're, you know, pretty well compensated.
Maintaining their employment. Actually, I have a question about that,
yeah.
Which is, Ott's seat will go vacant, as you said, August 1st.
Right.
And we'll talk maybe a little bit about how
sure.
he will be replaced. But what will happen to to that secretary and his chief deputy when his resignation takes effect? Will they stay there?
Well, unless somebody removes them.
Okay.
And the person that could remove them would be whoever the interim recorder is. I know that County Councilman Richard Snellgrove yesterday very bluntly said those two will not be there. The future does not look good for them in that office.
Ott's family recently obtained legal guardianship of him, and they had to essentially retrieve him from Sinone, from his secretary's
yeah.
house, right? And where is he now?
Well, he's at an undisclosed medical facility.
Okay.
The family and the attorneys yesterday didn't want to talk about that. But what we think is happening is that he's undergoing some evaluation, because while the family has attained a temporary legal guardianship, that's not a permanent decision. And so the judge wants some medical evaluation done before he can make the final determination of legal guardianship. And that kind of, I think, will have play into this contract too, because if the family's not legal guardianship, then they can't really sign this deal for him. The attorneys are very confident that the judge will you know, find in favor of the family, and that this contract that this agreement that they've put together will be ratified by the judge.
The story, when you get down to it, is actually it's a difficult one to process. It's kind of tragic.
Yeah.
But for a long time, there have been signs that Gary Ott has been suffering from something. And I guess the question that I have is, why has it taken as long as it has for this resolution to be reached?
Well, the problem is that Utah has no law of removal of an elected official for competency issues. You know, there's criminal activity, you can remove someone. There's no indication of that here. So really, the county leaders and everybody else was powerless to do anything about trying to remove Gary Ott. And so they were frustrated. They were trying to look for ways to do that. And no one really had legal control of Gary's affairs until the family came forward and petitioned for that in court and recently obtained that. So now they have the power to act in his behalf, and that's what they're doing with this agreement.
And it's a resignation, but I guess why is the county recorder, and this is more of a historical question than anything else, but why is the county recorder's position an elected position?
That's a great question. There's all kinds of county elected positions that you could question. Why are we electing a county surveyor? Can anyone name the county surveyor?
I'd have to do a Google search.
Very few people can do that. So we have the clerk, the recorder, the surveyor. And, you know, it does raise a question of really how far down do we elect our county officials there.
I want to leave this topic in just a moment, but how will the replacement of Ott occur? It's an appointment.
So what happens is, because he's a Republican, the Republican Party in the county will name his interim replacement. They'll probably do that through delegates deciding on anyone who declares their candidacy for this. Then they'll have 30 days. They submit that name to the county council, and then they ratify that decision, and the person steps into office as the interim. Now, because of the timing of this, this will go up on the election next year in November's election as a special election.
For a two-year term or for the—
For a two-year term, yeah, okay. Because right now it's slated to go through 2020. But they'll have an election because of the timing of this, and you know, then the permanent recorder will be chosen.
Okay, and we will see who that will become. In any case, we hope that Ott is getting the care that he needs, and we'll see where this story goes from here. There's quite a lot more on this story at sltrib.com, but we will leave it there for now. And I want to turn to some politics and government stories from this week and bring in Thomas Burr, Tribune Washington bureau chief. And Tommy, maybe we'll start with something that we knew was coming, news that you broke some months back, and that was that John Huntsman Jr. would be nominated to serve as ambassador to Russia. That nomination has now finally happened, right?
Yeah, it took a little while. So back in March, the White House confirmed to me that they were going to name John Huntsman as the ambassador to Russia, which, you know, we kind of expected. Okay, then we'll see the actual paperwork filed to the Senate, you know, soon after. And months ticked by with pretty much no response. I talked to one White House official a few months ago, and they said, there are no problems. It just takes some time for the vetting. But this week, the White House finally put out its announcement, sent it to the Senate, and said, "Okay, we're ready to nominate him." We could partially blame this on they wanted to get it right. It sounds like, you know, do the extreme vetting, if you want to use that term, that phrase, to make sure that there were no all the rocks were turned over and there was nothing amiss in his nomination. But there's also, you know, the White House has been a little bit distracted by other Russia interests, these special investigations going on, the congressional investigations, and that could have had part of delaying this. It's interesting, though, this announcement came out about 30 minutes after the Washington Post reported that Trump and Putin had another separate hour-long meeting at the G20 summit. The timing, I don't know if they planned it, if they're really brilliant, or they just put it out and didn't think about the timing.
Or if it was a coincidence. That undisclosed meeting that took place. Huntsman is expected to take this nomination, correct, Tommy? I mean, he said yes.
Yeah, he's been going through all the processing. You know, he had to, you know, go get a physical. He had to go, you know, fill out a lot of forms.
Sure.
He obviously is somebody who travels the world a lot, so they had to, you know, go through his travels. And there's also some interest. You know, he's on several corporate boards like Ford and Caterpillar, and he's the chairman of the Atlantic Council, so he's going to have to resign those positions when he's confirmed. And his family has businesses in Russia, so that was, I'm sure, part of what the State Department and the White House were looking at before they formally nominated him. The next step is, you know, there'll be a hearing in the Senate by the Foreign Relations Committee, which, you know, I'm sure the Democrats, maybe even some Republicans, will take the opportunity to talk about any possible collusion between Trump aides and Russians during the 2016 election, even though John Huntsman had no part of that. He wasn't part of the campaign. At one point, he even said that Pence should lead the ticket over Trump. So, you know, John Huntsman apparently, as far as we know, doesn't have any problems leading into this, but he's going to be wrapped up into this scandal.
You know, maybe I'm going to turn this to Dan Harry for just a moment, government editor. Ambassador to Russia at this point in time is a prominent appointment. And so in that sense, it's an opportunity for John Huntsman Jr. But it could also be, as Tommy's sort of hinting here, a politically problematic posting to accept as well. And I guess what I'm wondering is, do you imagine Huntsman might be worried about scandals rubbing off on him? And then how does he prevent that from happening?
Well, we've asked him that, and, you know, we should disclose, too, that John Huntsman is the brother of the Tribune owner, Paul Huntsman. You know, it does beg the question of what exactly does he see as the upside of this? You know, on the surface, I think it's very much a case where John Huntsman always has been one that says, you know, if my country calls me, I'm going to serve. He said that very thing when he was called by a president of the opposite party, Barack Obama, to be the ambassador to China. And, you know, he'd recently won re-election as governor, but he said, you know, when a president calls, I answer. And I do think that is something that the Huntsman father, John Sr., has kind of inculcated into his children, that this idea of service. If you read his book, you know, he talks about that a lot. So that's on the surface, you know, that's what he'll say, and that probably is right. But, you know, he's also a very smart individual, and you kind of got to think in his private musings, has to think, what am I getting myself into?
a tough decision to make, but he does have, as you said, a fair amount of diplomatic experience already in that you know, Tommy, actually, it's interesting. This comes at a time when at the embassy level, the relationship between Russia and the United States hasn't been exactly smooth either. There have been expulsions and reclaiming of property. It just makes it all the more complicated, I imagine.
Yeah, it's going to be a challenging position, no matter what. He's got to deal with the Russian sanctions, the questions of you know, will the United States give back two compounds that it seized from the Russians after the election? Then the Trump White House is very interested in this whole adoptions thing, which comes after sanctions against people who are suspected or convicted of human rights abuses. There's so many touchy issues that he's going to be walking into. First, we have to get him
confirmed.
He has to get confirmed.
When will that happen?
Yeah, that's a good question. His name is formally sent to the Senate. They're in session right now through, you know, the mid-August, and they come back in September. It could take a little while. I don't think there's any issues that we can see so far. You know, Huntsman's been confirmed three times now in a voice vote without any opposition by the Senate. So it's just a matter of getting through that probably tough hearing and getting on the calendar under when they've got a lot of other things waiting action.
Just a comment from a commenter at sltrib.com kind of speaks to the difficulties of I guess, joining the Trump administration for John Huntsman. This is a commentator, armchair naturalist, that's their handle, says, any respect for John Huntsman is now gone. And I'm assuming that that's because of concerns about the Trump administration, that if you are connected to the Trump administration during this difficult time, that might, again, rub off. And Tommy, just to remind us, John Huntsman Jr., during the campaign, wasn't exactly a Trump surrogate or a Trump supporter, though he kind of came around at the end.
Yeah, so at the beginning, when it became clear that Trump was going to be the nominee, John Huntsman said it was time to rally around the nominee, and he never gave any kind of full-throated endorsement of Trump by any means. After the Access Hollywood video came out, Huntsman said that Mike Pence should lead the ticket, essentially saying that Trump should step down off the ticket. But then he did meet with Trump and talk about the possibility of being Secretary of State. So that was an issue there for a little while. Not to defend Huntsman, that's not my job, but right. As Dan was alluding to earlier, too, I think there's an issue here with, Huntsman is always willing to serve his country, and perhaps, he feels like maybe being an adult in the room could help smooth relations if somebody is a skilled diplomat in doing this, who's been doing it for a very long time, could help smooth over those rough edges right now.
Dan Harry.
Yeah, one of the big problems I think he would face is that you can never tell when the president is going to say something to undermine you. I mean, Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, who was Trump's strongest and one of his first supporters in the campaign, is finding that out right now. In an interview with the New York Times the other day, the president said, if he would have known that Jeff Sessions was going to recuse himself from the Russia investigation, he never would have appointed him to the position, and he should have told the president that. And this guy is his biggest loyalist. So what can you expect when you're over there representing the government and you've got a guy back home in the White House that could say anything at any time?
Complicating matters. Tommy, just a minor detail before we head to a break, but I understand there was a typo in this official nomination.
Yes, the White House, when it put out the intent to nominate, spelled John Huntsman's name as J-O-H-N. Of course, Utahns know that it's J-O-N.
Right.
But, just to be fair, John Huntsman's campaign, when he ran for president, it started off in 2011, actually misspelled his own name as well. So, give him a little credit there.
Well, I was thinking that maybe another John Huntsman out there just won a sort of lottery and will randomly end up as ambassador to Russia, but maybe that's
with this White House, who knows?
Okay, well, guys, we need to head to our first break of the show, and when we return, we will talk about the Democratic candidate vying to replace Senator Orrin Hatch, and we'll delve into a newly unveiled 50-year state water plan. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Back after this short break.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For podcasts and more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr, government editor Dan Harry, and environment reporter Emma Penrod. It's our weekly news roundup, and we welcome your questions and comments at either sltrib.com or the KCPW Facebook page, or call us up at 801-355-8255. Thomas Burr, returning to you now, we learned that there is officially a Democratic challenger in the race for Senator Orrin Hatch's seat that will take place next year, and it's a name that's not unfamiliar to residents of the Salt Lake Valley. Tell us about this.
Yeah, we actually knew this. So Jenny Wilson, as a Salt Lake County Council member, a Democrat, had said she was going to explore running for the Senate in 2018. This week she made it official. She filed with the Federal Elections Commission. She's raised some money so far, and she says she really hopes to run against Senator Orrin Hatch. Of course, Hatch says he intends to run, but it hasn't made it official that he's going to run for an eighth term. But Jenny Wilson is in, so we have our first official candidate running for the Senate. And like I say, we're not sure if Hatch is going to be there or not for her to run against. But Jenny Wilson's a pretty well-known name. Her father was, former Salt Lake City Mayor Ted Wilson, who ran the Hinckley Institute for a long time. A pretty, household name in Salt Lake County, at least. It's something where she represents about, and Dan can correct me, about a third of Utahns already. So that's a good start. But Orrin Hatch is
right.
A household name for sure.
Okay. You said that we don't know whether or not Hatch is going to run. He hasn't really decided yet. There was a Utah policy poll that you mentioned in this article showing that 8 out of 10 voters are in Utah are opposed to that idea of Hatch running again. That could almost have a candidate like Wilson hoping for him to run again, right?
Yeah, certainly. And then that's why she said in her statement when she announced that she really hopes to run against him. That would give her a little bit of an edge rather than somebody, some new blood by any means. Hatch is 83 years old. He's been in the Senate about half his life. And serving since, 1977. So, there's certainly some pushback in the state, it sounds like, by our polling, showing that Utahns are maybe ready for somebody new. But as Hatch's office pushes back, he's chairman of the Senate Finance Committee. He's Senate President pro tem, so he's in a lot of the leadership meetings. He talks to President Trump frequently. They're saying, look, he has a good seat of power right now to help Utah. And they also noted that if he decides to run, he will win.
Tommy, hold that. This is the argument that Hatch and his surrogates are making. Experience, seniority. He's the chair of the Senate Finance Committee. Robert Gerke, opinion columnist from the Salt Lake Tribune, just walked in to the studio here, and I want to ask him, how important is all of that to Utah voters?
Yeah, how do people just get to wander in here? That's what I'm.
Yeah. I was in,
and welcome to the show,
I was
Robert.
In the neighborhood. I was actually homeless downtown. I think it is. Significant for Utah voters, actually. I mean, they've reelected him repeatedly, but Tommy pointed to the polling numbers that said 80% want somebody else.
That was, by the way, a Salt Lake Tribune Hinckley Institute poll.
My
not
apologies.
A Utah
My
policy.
Apologies.
But you know, six years ago, when he was getting ready to run again last time, there were similar polls out that were somewhere around 70% of voters didn't want him to run again or wanted somebody else to run again. So I think that polling can be a little bit misleading because he went on to win with about 70% of the vote. And so, if he decides to run again with the money he's got and with the history he's got, I think voters will end up coming around. I was listening to the discussion earlier about John Huntsman going to Russia, and I think that was probably one of the biggest things he could have done to help himself. And I think he had a hand in getting John Huntsman that ambassadorship to Russia, because it's awfully hard to run for Senate if you're the ambassador to Russia, as we've seen. Yep. So, I think right now, I think we've still got a little bit of time before we see him make a decision. And I know there's work going on behind the scenes. He's got campaign people who are working as if he were going to run again.
Laying the groundwork,
and not really knowing if he is or not.
Tommy, how close is, just out of curiosity, how close is Hatch to becoming, say, the longest serving senator, in history?
He's the longest-serving Republican senator in history, but he has a little bit to go to be the longest-serving senator.
Right.
I'd have to look. I think he's like fifth or sixth right now. Time frame. He's got a little bit to go.
Okay. You've got Robert Byrd, who I think was over 50 years, and so he's got some time left. Pat Leahy, who's in there now, has served longer than he has. As Tommy mentioned, the longest-serving Republican senator.
Right. Are there any rumored other GOP contenders? We're talking about Jenny Wilson here, but assuming that Hatch doesn't run, or for that matter, potentially there could be a primary challenge, are there other rumored names out there of challengers to Hatch? Not that you want to spread rumors.
Well, not really, though. I mean, that's kind of one of the surprising things, is even though everybody wants somebody else to run, that somebody else hasn't really materialized yet. I think he will get a challenger if he decides to run. The flip side of that is if he decides not to run, there's still sort of a vacuum there, right? I mean, there's a lot of people who have been kind of eyeing that seat for a long time. Sean Reyes is always mentioned. There's been talk about maybe a Josh Romney or, Jason Chaffetz was kind of floated around there for a while. I think Tommy can address that. Jason has said he's not planning on running again since he just left the House. So there are some people.
Derek Miller was mentioned.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's right. Derek Miller has kind of indicated that he'll probably run regardless. He's the head of the World Trade Center, Utah,
okay.
He's a bright guy, but he's not very well known, and so rallying the money could be difficult.
Okay, a little bit of time to make those decisions, of course. We'll circle back around to Tribune Washington bureau chief Thomas Burr a little bit later on the show, but I want to quickly duck into another story now. And this is one that is from the environment desk. And actually, hang on. Let's hold that thought for a moment and turn to the story of Jason Chaffetz's vacant 3rd District seat in Congress. And one of the Republican candidates in this race may have a surrogate coming to town. And I'm not certain if anybody here in studio covered the story, but this is Chris Herrod and sort of the ultra-conservative in that race. Who's he got coming to town to support him?
So his campaign says they expect Ted Cruz to make an appearance here in Utah for Chris. Chris ran Cruz's presidential campaign here in Utah, and you know, as if you remember that, that seems a long time ago now. But Cruz really came out number one in the Republican caucus voting here.
Sure. Well, so a big name in the Republican Party, Ted Cruz, a friend of Utah Senator Mike Lee.
Yeah.
Have any of the other candidates in this race received sort of high profile of endorsements?
Well, John Curtis is focusing on mayors. He's got, I think, 19 mayors that have endorsed him, and a lot of them from Utah County. And he figures that, you know, people know who their mayors are. So that's a his campaign believes that's a pretty strong endorsement.
Yeah, and Chris, in addition to having Ted Cruz come out, he got the endorsement from Rand Paul. And, you know, Ted Cruz, keep in mind, he won the Utah primary quite handily, I believe, like 70%, if I remember right.
And Herrod ran his campaign.
And Herrod was his state, he was the state chairman for the campaign here. And so, you know, he's got some connections there. I think it's probably also telling that I don't think Ted Cruz would be endorsing or planning to come out here without having to talk to Mike Lee about this first. And so there's probably some at least blessing or acknowledgement that you know, Lee's supportive of that as well. So, I mean, you know, and it's interesting because you do have this situation where typically Republicans don't campaign against Republicans, but there's this ongoing divide between those who believe that the actual Republicans go through convention and the fake Republicans, the rhinos, are the ones who go to the primary through the signature path. So,
and Herrod is the only one who I mean, Herrod got the
he got the nomination at convention. Okay. Yeah.
Curtis participated but did not finish well.
He didn't do very well.
John Curtis mayor pro bono.
Yeah. So you've got this, and it's a telling thing where there was a recent poll that showed John Curtis was sort of well out in front of the rest of the field right now among the Republican primary voters. But, you know, if he does win convincingly, it does raise questions, I think, about the validity of the convention process.
Guys, well, the primary election is, what, now just about 2.5 weeks out, August 15th, and I'm sure there'll be a lot of jockeying for position up until that time. And I imagine that we'll return to the story before then, but I do want to leave politics behind for a little bit here and turn to the environment desk, which I was going to do. And news about water planning. And Emma Penrod, first off, welcome again to the show.
Thank you.
And a 50-year state water management plan was released this week. Who was in charge of drafting that plan, first off?
Yeah, this was drafted by a 40-member team of volunteers who were all experts in one way or another on some topic related to water. Some were water managers, some were involved with environmental conservation organizations. Some were farmers. So it was really quite a broad, diverse group of individuals. And the governor invited all of these people on a voluntary kind of basis to come together and write a plan mapping out, you know, and spelling out what needs to be done. What do we all agree are the common goals for, you know, water in Utah for the next 50 years? And they spent about 4 years working on this document, going back and forth, collecting public comment, trying to, you know, work among themselves to see if they could come to consensus. That was really a big part of this for them, is they really wanted this to be a consensus document that everyone agreed these were common goals. And then the governor finally said, you know what, it's due. Give me a final version. And they did that this week.
What's in the plan? I mean, what is the plan? What are those goals?
Yeah, so it's a 106-page report, and
so condense it in like 2 minutes. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah, but among, you know, some of the highlights there, there's a whole chapter on water conservation strategies. You know, not just saying, you know, Utah should conserve water, but trying to spell out Utah might try this or Utah might try that. Maybe more towns could have some kind of ordinance encouraging, you know, low water landscapes. Maybe we could look at how we pay for water. And then, you know, there's a chapter on you know, one of the more controversial issues of water development, right, that does continue to recommend the construction of large water projects, like the Bear River Project and the Lake Powell Pipeline, which some people on the panel there still don't feel should have been in the document.
Can I ask, just will you remind us what those pipelines are for, essentially? What would they do?
Well, the state argument is that, you know, Utah is a quickly growing area, and that in order to sustain and provide for this growth, Utah is going to need more water in certain critical areas, including on the Wasatch Front and in the St. George area. So Lake Powell Pipeline would pipe water from Lake Powell over to St. George to provide water there. The Bear River Project would develop parts of the Bear River that remain, you know, undeveloped, dams, pipelines, these kinds of things to provide more water to the Wasatch Front.
You know, let's actually veer into another story here that you wrote this week, Emma. It's about the National Audubon Society. It's not a small organization, a national conservation organization, which released a report, which is looking at the health of the Great Salt Lake and shorebird populations. And the tie-in here is the Bear River is maybe the largest tributary, I think, of the Great Salt Lake, and the lake is, according to this report, shrinking or shrunken.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that. What's the idea here is that by diverting the Bear River, you know, the tie-in here, I guess, is that by diverting the Bear River, you would further shrink the lake.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this report, it actually looked at the health of several waterways that are critical to shorebirds, including a whole network of these saline lakes across the western U.S. Of course, you know, you can't ignore the Great Salt Lake when you're talking about that particular topic. And what they found was that since, you know, human diversion of water from the Great Salt Lake has, you know, really increased in earnest in the last 150 years or so, that the lake, the size of the lake seems to have decreased by nearly 50%. And after looking at that, they decided, you know, we're going to create this initiative. We're going to open an office in Salt Lake City. We're going to hire more staff, and we're going to become more, you know, politically and you know, policy involved to, you know, see if we can't find some way to guarantee water for the Great Salt Lake and other lakes. They do plan to work on other lakes as well, but it is headquartered here, and the Great Salt Lake is, you know, a focal point.
Right next door. Again, the number to call to join this conversation, 801-355-TALK. And according to this report, a diminished lake or any lake, any of these saline lakes in this report, because they are important stopovers for migratory birds, that essentially this could affect whole species of
mm-hmm.
animals.
Yeah.
So they're planning, what, legal interventions, conservation initiatives,
mm-hmm.
and, as you said, policy work as well?
Mm-hmm. And they've only had a director for this initiative for 5 months, just barely 5 months. They don't have an office yet. They're looking for a space, still planning to bring, you know, more staff on board to help them out. So they haven't really mapped out exactly what they plan to do here. But one of the things we did discuss was the Bear River Project. And they want to take a very collaborative approach. They don't want to come across as being, you know, anti-growth or anti, you know, anything really. What they want to do is sit down with stakeholders and have discussions about what can we do to ensure that there is adequate water for people and adequate water for the lake and for the birds. So one of the things they did talk about wanting to do is maybe see if there are alternatives to the Bear River Project that wouldn't include diverting water out of the Bear River and would maybe include more conservation efforts or more efforts to use less water rather than needing that diversion. The Bear River is one of the main sources of unmodified water flow into the Great Salt Lake at this point.
So news doesn't break simultaneously, but it kind of did actually in this case, but the state would appear to be making motions to charge forward with these pipelines, according to this water strategy plan
mm-hmm.
that you mentioned. And then I guess the question that I have is how secure, how firm are those plans to march ahead with the Lake Powell and Bear River pipelines?
Well, both of these projects are projects that have already been approved by the state legislature. There are laws on the books in Utah that say the state of Utah will build these projects. So you could take that to mean it's almost a done deal. However, there has been indications by, state officials that maybe we could delay these projects, perhaps, if we didn't need them as early as we thought we did. The Lake Powell pipeline is further in the planning process. They're in the process of trying to obtain federal permits to get the ball rolling there. Bear River project, new population estimates suggest maybe we don't need it as soon as we thought. So that one keeps getting pushed back.
I guess this is a hard question for a reporter, but are these pipelines necessary? On the opposite side, you have, as you point out, Audubon, but other conservation groups saying what?
Well, the conservation groups have largely argued that there is not the data available to support the need for these pipelines. The state, of course, says, well, of course there is. Here's our data. But they have acknowledged in recent months that some of that data is maybe not as strong or as solid as maybe some people might think. And so there is some question as to, exactly how much water is needed in Utah. We don't have accurate numbers necessarily on how much water is even used because of issues like, secondary water systems, people who use, non-culinary water to water their lawns or gardens, that kind of thing. A lot of these systems in Utah don't have meters. And we know that the majority of the water use in Utah is used outdoors, not indoors. So that suggests that perhaps the majority of the water use in Utah, we don't have, a full grasp on how much water we're using right now, much less how much water we would be using in the future.
And isn't there a question of allocation as well? I mean, a lot of the water use in Utah is agricultural, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes. The number thrown around is 80%, but these numbers are often based on estimates, and it's hard to, gauge exactly where the numbers lie.
Robert Gerke, some expensive water projects planned for the future in this state water plan. Your editorializing columnist's take on this?
Well, I think, this Lake Powell pipeline in particular has been kicked around for years, and it keeps coming back to, do we need it to facilitate the growth, and can we afford it? The question of how to pay for it, and, do taxpayers in the Wasatch Front and northern Utah end up paying to subsidize people, to subsidize runaway growth in St. George and places around there? Is a pretty valid question, I think. I don't remember the exact projected cost of the Lake Powell pipeline, but it's
well over $1 billion.
Yeah, it's not cheap, and so do we want to spread that pain around to people who won't see any direct benefit from it? And as Emma hit on, do we actually need it? I mean, even the governor in his last budget document questioned whether it's needed right now, whether we can postpone this by doing some conservation and so forth.
Guys, I'm sorry, we have to run to another break here. And thank you for this reporting on this, Emma. And I want to stick with some environmental news when we come back from a break, namely the visit by EPA Director Scott Pruitt to Utah. At the moment, though, time for another quick break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For podcasts and more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Robert Gerke, Emma Penrod, Dan Harry, and Thomas Burr. Call us up with your comments and questions. The number is 801-355-TALK. And we'll continue now with stories covered by environment reporter Emma Penrod. Emma, EPA Director Scott Pruitt came to town this week for a private meeting with the governor, I believe. Why was he here?
That's a good question. He indicated that he is on a tour across the U.S. to get inputs from these states on a variety of topics, in particular a issue called the Waters of the U.S. Rule, where they have been asked by courts to rewrite a definition of what waters the Clean Water Act, the Federal Clean Water Act, applies to.
A rule that was
kind
put
of
into...
highly...
technical.
Yes.
But it was a rule that was put into place under the Obama-era EPA, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Obama administration EPA.
Yeah, the rule, meaning the current definition of what this act applies to, they've We're trying to lend some clarity.
So also while he was here, Pruitt delivered a letter to Governor Gary Herbert. Tell us about that.
Yes. During that meeting, and it does appear there were possibly many topics of conversation throughout this meeting, during that meeting, he handed the governor a letter indicating that the EPA was going to be reconsidering their ruling that they issued in 2016 on the state's haze plan. This is the Federal Clean Air Act that has a section in there that discusses visibility in national parks and other similar kinds of areas, and mandates that by a certain date that the air eventually in these places should be pristine, that it shouldn't be what it is now because of human influence, that they want it to just be the natural air quality for the views.
Right.
And so this is about visibility. It's not necessarily about health. That's sometimes things people get confused. But then they have, these plans that the states are expected to write to implement to show how they're going to reduce pollution to improve visibility in these parks. So the state wrote a plan. And over a course of many years, the state went back and forth on whether or not a particular provision of this plan was adequate. And in 2016, the EPA finally came out and said, no, it's not adequate. And therefore, the way the Clean Air Act is written, what the EPA does is it comes in and it implements its own plan and overrides the state's plan.
And so that had happened. And now Pruitt is saying
we're going to reconsider that decision and presumably reconsider whether that perhaps the state's plan should be reinstated.
And what that means is that there's two coal-fired power plants near to Arches and Canyonlands, roughly, are the two national parks in question? And is this about Rocky Mountain Power updating its equipment or not having to do that now?
Yes, there's a very specific form of pollution control that the EPA's plan requires to be installed at these two Rocky Mountain Power coal plants, the Hunter and Huntington plants. The state's plan did not require the installation of this particular pollution control and said instead, the carbon plant closed and that should result in, adequate reduction of pollution because this plant closed. It is kind of a tricky thing in the law because the question is, can the state take credit for something that some would argue happened because of market forces?
Right.
So there's been this, it's been years that they have been debating this particular issue.
Okay, so a letter delivered that says we're going to reconsider this. We're quickly running out of time on the show here. And Emma, I'll just ask you this last question to close out this topic, which is there was some criticism over who Scott Pruitt met with, EPA Director Scott Pruitt, while he was here during his short visit, or maybe who he didn't meet with, I guess, is the idea.
Yeah, there has been some frustration voiced that he had apparently asked the governor's office to set up meetings with particular individuals or groups of individuals that he wanted input from. And environmental organizations have come out and expressed some frustration that none of those individuals were them.
Okay. All right, so some disappointment there. And Emma, I'm sorry, we will have to leave it at that for now. But there's more on this story and everything else that we've been discussing here on the show at sltrib.com. I'm rushing us through to the finish line here because it's time now for our underplayed stories of the week. And let's go around the table. Dan Harry, what's your pick for underplayed story?
I'm going to pick one of Emma's that was in the paper today. It was about the Native American summit that the governor held at Utah Valley University. And the Utes boycotted it. Mm. They feel that the state is disrespecting them, is not treating them as a sovereign nation. And so they wanted to make a statement of protest.
Some of this about Governor Gary Herbert seeming to speak for the tribe. But again, we'll leave that and you can check it out at sltrib.com. That's your underplayed pick, Dan Harry. How about you, Robert Gerke?
This one wasn't necessarily underplayed. It got pretty good play, but it was an interesting story that's worth reading. Peggy Fletcher Stack did a story about Lori Lee Hill, who was a stake president in Tooele when she was a man, and then became a woman, and the church excommunicated her, gave her an ultimatum and said, if you don't go back to being a man, we're going to excommunicate you. She continued to transition and now has been excommunicated by the church. And it's an interesting story and sort of a story of the times, I guess. These are issues that the church is now having to confront in a probably more frequently than they have in the past.
All right, check it out as well. Emma Penrod, your underplayed pick.
Yeah, so this is another Native American Affairs kind of story. A federal judge has ordered San Juan County to redraw their election district boundaries after finding that those boundaries were unconstitutional and did not grant Native Americans who live in that county adequate representation, but instead appeared to be drawn to try to maximize the influence of white individuals living in that county.
Mm, wow, so some forced... some redistricting that will happen as a result of a federal judge there in San Juan County. Interesting story. Thomas Burr, what's your pick?
You know, I'm going to go with something a little scary. So the president, Trump, has tweeted twice this morning, and both of them are using several emojis. So just a warning to those on Twitter, the president has discovered emojis.
Okay. He's excited for the emoji movie, right?
Beware.
Yeah.
Okay. This is one that I wanted to do a couple of weeks ago myself and never got around to it, but this is from the July 3rd Salt Lake Tribune, a piece about potato cultivation in Utah's Escalante Valley going back 11,000 years, the oldest cultivation of potatoes in North America. And the same varietal of potato that ancient people were eating way back when is still growing and being eaten by residents there. And it's an interesting piece. Check it out at sltrip.com. All right, Thomas Burr, Dan Harry, Emma Penrod, and Robert Gerke, all from the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for joining us on the show today.
Thank you. Have a good weekend.
We're going to wrap up the show this week with Salt Lake Tribune lifestyle columnist Marina Gomberg, who, just in time for Pioneer Day, joined me for a conversation about fireworks. Marina Gomberg, lifestyle columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
You wrote a column about fireworks in Utah, and it got a pretty big response, hundreds of comments. people have a lot to say about fireworks, but the gist of your, I'll give you the headline. It was, "I don't care if you love them, it's time we ban fireworks." You jumped from that, though, kind of into a, well, hold on a second, I apologize. It's not that I don't care.
Right. And I do. And, you know, and I can picture my dad reading it. And, of course, after he did, he was like, wait, after all this time we spent together, you don't like fireworks? Although I think he was mostly giving me the business because I outed him as being the man of 1,000 safety tips. But
I saw that. So, I mean, what's the problem? What's the big deal, Marina? Why are fireworks something that we should be worried about?
Well, I mean, first of all, like I said in my article, I think they're delightful. They're fun. They're really awesome. But I think, too, that we live in this, like, as I said in the column, kind of tinderbox of a place. Like, it is so dry. And not even just, like, outside of our neighborhoods, but people's lawns and people, everything is flammable. Not everything. Most things are flammable. And people did end up losing their homes, even after I wrote this column. And so it's a real hazard. And then we end up spending all of this money on firefighters who are out putting out blazes left and right.
This column published on July 3rd, and then July 4th happened, and yeah, there were 70 in Salt Lake County alone. There were 70 fires reported, and yeah, people did lose their homes. Is it worth it? Is the real question, and that's only one factor in all of this.
Right,
you pointed out some others as well.
Right, yeah. The other thing was, even starting before the 4th of July, people were getting fireworks, and I think the Monday, two Mondays before the 4th, the air quality was so bad for a temporary amount of time that had it stayed at that level, it would have been classified as purple,
right,
air quality. I didn't even know it existed. I didn't know it got worse than red. We were just like a step away from hazardous for an amount of time. Mm. And it's really bad on people's lungs. And so, and then when we do it for, you know, weeks before and after the 4th, and then there's no break between then and the 24th, and then a little bit after that, I mean, we just don't need any worse air here in Utah.
Well, it's a perennial problem. You also pointed out that our pets, our four-legged friends, have an issue. It's not easy for them.
No, it isn't. And all these sweet dogs are terrified, and I'm sure cats, too, if they care. But, you know, the other thing I didn't even write about that was kind of frustrating, and I was thinking about it afterward, and I felt like a bad mom, was I was trying to put my kid down, my sweet little one-year-old Harvey, and he woke up a couple times just terrified because it sounds like we're in a war zone. I mean, I'm sure he doesn't know what to fear, but loud noises are not fun when you're trying to sleep.
Well, and also for a parent trying to get a kid to go to sleep.
Not cool. Not cool at all.
Not cool, neighbors. Listen up. Actually, this brings me the loud noises, the sounds. It brings me to another point that you made, which has to do with people who are suffering a different, well, who are aware of loud noises and what they might be. And this is veterans.
Right. Yeah. And I think, like, if there's a group of people to honor as we honor our independence, it would be those who have fought for it. And so, like, maybe we shouldn't be terrorizing them, you know?
You mentioned a friend in your article who suffers from PTSD and how this is a traumatic experience for them.
Right. The sounds of fireworks are a lot like the sounds of war. And so, yeah, for people who have PTSD, whether it's from war or other things, it's a pretty horrifying experience. And not just for two nights of the year, you know, it's this entire month that they're either living in fear or constantly being jolted by the sounds of fireworks. And so I think it's kind of this compilation of all of these things where it's a fire hazard and it's bad for our air and our lungs and our minds and our babes and our pets. And so I'm not really sure it's worth the delight that people get to see on their kids' faces. You know, I just think, is it worth that? Could we find other ways to delight our kids? Probably, yeah.
Or maybe, you know, relegating it to a certain area for, you know, like a park. You know, you wrote this column July 3rd. I have to ask, did you go out on the 4th of July and watch fireworks?
I felt like I couldn't. Yeah. We didn't actually, but because it's a school night and, you know, we had to get Harvey down to bed. Yeah. But the truth of the matter is that I understand and I think that they're really fun. And I wonder if there was a space and time, you know, where it would be less bad, it would be more contained, fewer impacts that are negative on people and on air and all of that, then it would be interesting, you know, maybe to take Harvey to light a sparkler once in a while. I don't know.
All right. You had some ideas of kind of alternatives to celebrating with fireworks, our independence, this being a marker of independence, maybe we kind of pay it forward.
Yeah. Yeah. And in fact, my family started a tradition. We ended up dropping off a donation to the road home that day. Just, you know, thinking about people who are less independent, whether that's, you know, people who are refugees or people who are less mobile or whatever, but, you know, helping those who are less independent to become more so.
Hmm. Sort of creating fireworks in other people's lives.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good way to put it. Yeah. I like that. You want to write my next column?
Yeah, I'll be happy to. Thanks for the invitation. Well, Marina, we'll have to have you back for more conversations like this. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
Thanks so much for having me, Roger.
You're welcome.
Bye.
Bye. That was Salt Lake Tribune lifestyle columnist Marina Gomberg talking about fireworks to end this edition of Behind the Headlines. You can find all of her columns, a relatively new addition to the paper, at sltrib.com. That's it for this edition of the show. Thanks very much to Jesse Ellis here at KCPW for running the technical side of the show as usual. At Utah Public Radio, the broadcast is managed by Tom Williams, Spencer Holsey, Alyssa Roberts, and Christy Aachen. And thanks to the show's producer, Emily Means. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks so much for joining us, and have a great weekend.